If Mudge's career followed the same path as his Australian doppelganger, Aaron Barr's traced one closer to that of Bradley Manning, an aimless American teenager tempted into the military by the siren song of a top-secret clearance. Barr grew up in Hoquiam, Washington, a rough logging community in the same cluster of towns that produced Kurt Cobain. He remembers hardy, dirty people, drunken fights nightly, and more bars than churches. His father was an exception. A former mill worker, he had lost two fingers and part of his thumb to an industrial saw. That accident had produced a legal settlement, enough for the elder Barr to return to school and study Nietzsche. He would write poetry and take his son on long drives, quizzing him on history and politics. As a teen, Barr was given a Commodore 64 and spent hours reading programming magazines to tame its mysterious innards. He played Dungeons and Dragons, took apart and reassembled electronics, and joined his school's computer club. Then he discovered girls. A confident teen with a talent for sports, he found his focus on technology and education dissolving. By the time he graduated, he had a 2.7 GPA, the lowest of all his friends. Barr tried a few semesters at the local community college without much enthusiasm. But when a couple of old classmates joined the Army and told him about their experiences at boot camp, the 18-year-old was intrigued. He spoke with a Navy recruiter who wowed him with talk of code-breaking and privileged secrecy. "It sounded sexy to an 18-year-old," he says, "so I joined up." After a few years at a Florida naval base, Barr's technical affinity and the Navy's training had made him a competent practitioner of high-frequency direction finding, or HFDUF, the branch of signals intelligence aimed at analyzing the information wrapped up in a radio signal to locate its source. By the mid-90s, he had graduated to advanced signals analysis, what he describes as big, hard communications. Barr's team would intercept a radio signal, often a multi-layered collection of voice and data, unravel the strands of that information rope, and seek to understand it, sometimes breaking Russian and Chinese crypto with techniques unfit for public consumption. The Navy moved Barr to Rota, Spain, near the Strait of Gibraltar. Ships passing on to the Mediterranean Sea, Adriatic, or down the coast of Africa would request analysts for specific stints, and Barr would often be helicoptered out to spend weeks on whatever aircraft carrier he was assigned to. He remembers those missions and the leaves between them as some of the best experiences of his life. Roasting chicken on an isolated beach in the Ivory Coast, or drinking formaldehyde-tinged beer with locals in an Odessa bar. In 1998, NATO entered the war in Kosovo, and in 1999, the Marines needed SIGINT analysts to support their incursion into the war-torn region. Barr, then serving on the USS Kearsarge, volunteered. "I thought it would be neat," he says. "I'm kind of an outdoorsy guy." Soon he found himself on a helicopter to Macedonia, then camping in a disused chicken farm near Nilarne, Kosovo. He and his Marine companions brought what they could carry, ate meals from bags, and went the entire month-long mission without showering. Barr slept under the stars. "I couldn't even stand my own smell, not to mention the four other men in my tent," he says. Soon, his platoon moved into an empty police station in the city's downtown and began its work. Much of the fighting was over. NATO had already been dropping bombs for a year. But the lingering Serbian presence under the command of alleged war criminal Slobodan Milosevic continued to attack NATO forces, and Albanians continued to retaliate against the Serbs. Barr's group was dispatched to track down and break up pockets of violence. The signals analyst turned soldier would be sent into combat with two oversized and armored Tadpole Unix laptops strapped to his body, one as a backup, and a pair of transceivers with antennae designed for intercepting and interpreting radio communications. He hadn't been certified to carry heavy weapons, so he was given only a 9mm pistol. The Marines joked that if they took fire, he would be the first to be shot because the weapon made him look like an officer. In the end, the United States and its allies suffered zero combat casualties in Kosovo. but Barr left the peacekeeping mission with a bitter taste in his mouth. I was struck by the folly of the exercise, how we had no business inserting ourselves into a battle that had been going on for centuries, he says. He recalled one Albanian man who was detained by the troops for possessing weapons. He told the interpreter that the Serbs had killed his wife and kids, says Barr. What else was he supposed to do, he asked us. It was hard to argue with that. Barr left the military 2 years later and took a job for the defense contractor TRW in Unix Systems Administration. But in 2003, he began a master's degree in cybersecurity at Colorado Technical College in Colorado Springs. With a classmate who would later become a co-founder of HB Gary Federal, Ted Vera, he drove around the town with an antenna, combing the streets for security vulnerabilities in local networks. That process was called war driving, a modern take on the war dialing technique that hackers like Mudge had used decades earlier. The two applied for a single position as a cyber warrior at Northrop Grumman, with the agreement that whichever was hired would try to bring the other on later. Instead, they were both hired together to work as a team. At the time, the defense industrial base was just beginning to be vivisected by cyber spies, a phenomenon that today has become a full-blown hemorrhaging of data from government and private industry. Just as Barr and Vera were finishing their master's degrees, The Washington Post reported the attack on Sandia National Laboratories and the defense contractor Lockheed Martin that would become known as Titan Rain. The advanced intrusion had penetrated some of the military's deepest research secrets, including 400 pages of proprietary documents and plans for the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, a satellite whose technology could be repurposed for military applications. The culprits were methodical and untraceable, sussing out the target networks, siphoning off sensitive data, and covering their tracks in minutes. The stolen data could be tracked back to servers in the Guangdong province of China. But the thieves themselves hid behind layers of proxies that kept them altogether anonymous. At Northrop Grumman, Barr taught a class to Department of Defense officials on social media vulnerabilities, scaring them with demonstrations of how LinkedIn and Facebook profiles could be used to case potential target organizations, gleaning information for social engineering attacks. The young defense exec began to wonder if the same attacks couldn't be used against the Pentagon's faceless enemies, too. Matching characteristics of the malicious software planted by cyber spies with any personal information they leaked to the world. It hit me. We could apply social media analysis with a different problem set. Instead of working our way into an organization, maybe we could identify individuals who didn't want to be ID'd, he says. The military was desperate for any solution to the attribution problem, and Northrop was eager to sell Barr's solution. He rose to chief engineer and then technical director of a division, managing $20 million in annual research budget. Aaron Barr, the humble enlisted man, had become Aaron Barr, the defender of American secrets and slayer of anonymity. In 1998, Richard Clark, President Clinton's head of national security, came to Boston on a self-guided educational tour to learn about the growing risk of cyber attacks on American critical infrastructure. A legal counsel to the White House suggested he meet Mudge, whose name had begun to be passed around as a smart, articulate hacker without the taint of a criminal record. Clark was told to come alone to John Harvard's brewhouse, just a block away from the same Au Bon Pain that hosted the city's hacker underground. He sat, drank a vodka on the rocks, and waited. No one showed up. 30 minutes later, his drink long finished, Clark began to pay the bill and leave when Mudge, who had been sitting at the bar sizing up Clark since he arrived, announced himself. "You were only going to wait half an hour?" Mudge asked. Mudge had been watching for Clark to reveal what other agent he had brought with him. He was surprised to see that such a high-level cabinet official traveled alone to clandestine meetings with digital miscreants. Over the rest of the evening, they drank and talked about how to break the internet and put it back together. A few weeks later, Mudge invited Clark back to the loft. It was a strange scene. One of the country's top feds, with four members of the National Security Council at his side, in the digital lion's den. But Clark's endless curiosity charmed and flattered the young hackers. He pulled out his Palm Pilot and asked what sorts of security flaws it might have. Kingpin plugged it into a device he'd created that could quickly crack the device's password and siphon off its files in seconds. Clark quizzed them about vulnerabilities in the country's critical infrastructure. Soon they were deep in a discussion about BGP hijacking, a then theoretical trick. BGP, or Border Gateway Protocol, is the language used by the routers that connect major carriers like AT&T and Quest. Taking advantage of a bug in those routers could detour large chunks of the internet or send it into a black hole. The same exploit is still possible today. And some researchers believe it was used to mysteriously reroute a significant fraction of the internet through China for 18 minutes in April 2010. For a moment, Clark huddled with his NSC colleagues in private conversation. But Mudge interrupted, chiding the feds for excluding him and his hacker friends on their own turf. So Clark repeated what they had just been discussing. Until his visit, he had believed that only state-sponsored hackers were capable of what the Loft's members were showing him. "Have any governments asked you to do technical work for them?" he asked. "No," Mudge said with a smile. "But if you're willing to be the first, we're willing to entertain offers." Clark wanted lawmakers to see what he had seen. So in April 1998, he helped arrange for Mudge to be invited to speak at a congressional hearing. Mudge insisted that if the legislators wanted his presence, the entire loft would need to testify together. So the eight hackers piled into a rented van with tinted windows they'd outfitted with war-driving antennas and drove to Washington. On the way, they stopped at the NSA's Cryptologic Museum and accidentally drove past the guards into the agency's secure facility before timidly backing out. They visited the museum, played with its Nazi-built Enigma encryption machine, and took turns posing for photos in front of a computer in the museum's exhibition on the rising threat of cyber attacks. It was, in other words, a giddy hacker field trip. Later, at the hearing before senators that included John Glenn, Fred Thompson, and Joe Lieberman, the group rattled off a terrifying list of flaws in America's digital backbone. Mudge, his mane of hair spilling over the lapels of a gray suit and tie, stole the show and the next day's headlines by explaining BGP hijacking, a trick that he warned the legislators could take down the entire internet in half an hour. Before the hackers left the chamber, Senator Thompson told the group that they were performing a valuable service to their country. Lieberman compared them to Rachel Carson and Paul Revere. Then, the loft went off for a tour of the White House Situation Room and ended their trip hanging out with Secret Service agents at Archibald's, a nearby strip club. After the Senate hearing, the loft felt like it had overgrown its after-work hacker clubhouse. So Mudge engineered a deal with a young company called At Stake, a venture capitalist-backed consultancy based in Cambridge that would make the loft its research lab. As Hunter S. Thompson would say, the weird were turning pro. But soon after the loft moved into its swanky new building, complete with Aeron chairs and a 100-gallon aquarium where a new tropical fish was added for each new employee, Mudge began to disappear for long stretches. "Where's Mudge?" became a mantra, eventually a bitter slogan among the rest of the group. Then the dot-com crash hit. Budgets were eviscerated, clients evaporated, even At-Stake's tropical fish began to die. The loft's members began to be laid off one by one, starting with Space Rogue and Brian Oblivion. And where was Mudge? Much of the time he was in Washington. After the Senate hearing, the rest of the loft left the political limelight, but Mudge went in deeper. He was invited to an off-site meeting of legislators in West Virginia and convinced the politicos to offer him a ride on the congressional bus instead of the one reserved for guests. For the entire drive, he held court with some of the country's most powerful politicians, sharing internet war stories and fielding questions. In 2000, as cyber attacks began to pound major websites like Amazon and Yahoo, Mudge was asked to attend a National Security Council meeting on cybersecurity at the White House, where he sat two seats away from the president. In 2002, Mudge's frequent absence became official. He announced that he was taking a year's sabbatical. Some say he left at stake for personal reasons, others because he was doing sensitive work for the government. Regardless, he never returned. Eventually, after most of the loft's hackers left at stake, the startup was sold to the security giant Symantec at a price low enough that it didn't affect the antivirus giant's accounting enough to be disclosed. We had had a clubhouse, and it was communal and close-knit and awesome. And then we threw it all away, recalls Kingpin. It was a typical sellout. Mudge wouldn't reappear on the cybersecurity scene for another 2 years. When he did, it was with a research paper focused on a little discussed problem, the insider threat. Mudge's scenario started with a counterintuitive assumption that the evildoer was already inside the company's network. Then it suggested ways that malicious insider might get data out, whether it be moving large amounts of information, accessing unusual elements of the company's network, or using obfuscation techniques like reverse HTTP tunnels, a technique of disguising outgoing data as web traffic. Like a mole in a government agency, the greatest value is achieved through unnoticed longevity in the target environment, Mudge wrote in another late 2003 article for the Journal of the Unix-focused group Usenix. The expected movement and characteristics of information and its handling related to business functions must change in these cases, providing us with the ability to identify such covert activities. In other words, with a constant eye toward molish behavior in your employees and their computers, those moles can be whacked. The idea grabbed the attention of two brothers, Jonathan and Justin Bingham, who raised $19 million from venture capital firms and made Mudge chief scientist of a startup called Intrusic. Intrusic never got off the ground and folded 3 years later. Mudge blames its failure on infighting and bad business decisions caused by friction between the Binghams. He would spend the next 3 years before his government appointment at the contractor BBN Technologies. Why did Intrusic fail? Some say its problems went beyond family tensions. Like the loft, it was populated largely by 20-something researchers. One analyst who worked with the startup, John Oltzik, describes it as lacking adult supervision and producing tools that worked for hackers but never had the polish and the disciplined development cycle of business software. Mudge makes a great evangelist and champion, says Oltzik. I would never give him execution responsibility. But the fundamental flaw in Intrusic's business may have had less to do with management than the nature of the eternal problem the company hoped to solve. The company's technology could never provide the easy litmus test for insider misbehavior that customers wanted. Its tools were hardly an automatic mole-whacking machine. Like its competitors, the company's products required humans to monitor and analyze the data they produced. And just as important, there was a cultural barrier to pushing insider threat software. Mudge himself, in his Usenix journal article, had already guessed at that hard sell. Perhaps, whether accurate or not, it is too painful for organizations to entertain the notion that they might already be compromised. Being overrun by reverse HTTP tunnels might be an easier pill to swallow than accepting that these reverse tunnels are symptoms of actions initiated from internal machines that are already compromised. Politically and culturally, companies simply didn't want to accept that they were teeming with leaks. When the Financial Times story about Aaron Barr's research hit the web, Anonymous quietly moved into action. strange traffic began hitting the H.B. Gary Federal website. It appeared to be a distributed denial-of-service attack, Anonymous's usual tactic of clogging a site with phony data requests. DDoS fuckers, Barr wrote to his colleagues. Privately, he was relieved. A mere DDoS attack he could handle. But Barr had hit at Anonymous's deepest nerve, its anonymity. And the id of the internet wasn't content merely causing his website some downtime. H.B. Gary Federal used custom software for managing its website, and the anonymous hackers quickly combed the site and found a critical flaw in the code. When the software stored data in a database, it didn't always differentiate that information from executable commands. With a trick called SQL injection, a user could pretend to be entering something as innocuous as a username and password, but in fact include characters that triggered actions on the website's back end, even actions like coughing up sensitive data. H.B. Gary's attackers sussed out the flaw immediately and used it to access the company's password database. But the security firm hadn't been altogether careless. Instead of storing the passwords unprotected, it had scrambled them with a type of encryption called cryptographic hashes. Hashes are mathematical functions designed to be irreversible. When a user entered a password, H.B. Gary's server would perform a hash that converted it to a unique number and checked whether that number matched the one in the database. But the function couldn't be used in the other direction, to start with a number and reverse the hash to find the password. So storing the numbers instead of the passwords helped protect them against hackers. In theory, at least. In practice, with a bit of crypto savvy, an attacker can feed every possible password into a hashing function, simply trying them all until one matches. By pre-computing hashes of entire dictionaries of passwords, codebreakers can use so-called rainbow tables to vastly speed up the process. The attack could be prevented by salting the hashes, injecting random numbers to make the operations far more difficult. But like Microsoft in 1998, H.B. Gary didn't use salting. As Mudge would say, kindergarten crypto. The process was made easier still by the fact that Barr's password was short and simple. KIBAFO33. The attackers had it in minutes. Barr, being a systems administrator himself, as well as H.B. Gary Federal's chief executive, had administrative privileges on H.B. Gary's network. He could reset the password of any other user. So once the attackers owned his account, they owned all of them. Barr had used the same password again and again. So Anonymous soon had access to his Twitter feed and H.B. Gary's homepage. And most crucially, the more than 70,000 emails archived on the company's servers. And for one last laugh, the Anons also decided to hack the personal website of H.B. Gary's Greg Hoglund, rootkit.com. So, like Assange in his Shakespearean phone hack 25 years earlier, they set about using a bit of social engineering. The hackers found the name of a systems administrator for the site who worked for Nokia in Finland. Pretending to be Hoglund, they emailed the administrator. I'm in Europe and need to SSH into the server. Can you drop open up firewall and allow SSH through port 59022 or something vague? Then they tried two passwords they had found in his mail archive. Is our root password still 88J4BB3RW0CKY88? Or did we change it to 88SCR3AM3R88? It is W0CKY, though no remote root access allowed, the Finn answered. Just reset my password to change me 123 and give me public IP, and I'll SSH in and reset my PW. Your password is change me 123. I am online, so just shoot me if you need something. Anonymous hackers had utterly disemboweled H.B. Gary and H.B. Gary Federal. They set about defacing the company's websites and Barr's Twitter account while deleting a terabyte of backup data and research materials. The hackers used Barr's own Twitter account to publish his home address, social security number, and other personal information. Then they posted a long message on H.B. Gary's homepage. "You think you've gathered full names and home addresses of the higher-ups of Anonymous? You haven't. You think Anonymous has a founder and various co-founders? False. You believe that you can sell the information you found to the FBI? False. Now, why is this one false? We've seen your internal documents, all of them. And do you know what we did? We laughed. Most of the information you've extracted is publicly available via our IRC networks. The personal details of Anonymous members you think you've acquired are, quite simply, nonsense. You have blindly charged into the Anonymous hive, a hive from which you've tried to steal honey. Did you think the bees would not defend it? Well, here we are. You've angered the hive, and now you are being stung. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us, always." Just who pulled off the epic hack remains unclear. But one hacker named Sabu would later claim in a conversation on Anonymous's elite IRC channel HQ that he had rooted their boxes, cracked their hashes, owned their emails, and social engineered their admins in hours. Whoever it was, they seem to have learned something from the tactics of WikiLeaks. The Anonymous hackers set up their own website, calling it AnonLeaks. Then, partly to prove how little they thought of Barr's work, they published the entire stolen contents of H.B. Gary's mail archive, including his database of Anonymous's purported identities, adding a search feature for easy reading of the executive's most personal messages, the tool that provided me with much of the material for this story. At first, only the emails of executives from H.B. Gary Federal were included. Penny Levy, Greg Hoglund's wife and president of H.B. Gary, was sent into an Anonymous IRC channel to negotiate by instant message on behalf of H.B. Gary and prevent the release of the rest of the emails. Sabu addressed her immediately. "Penny, before we get started, know that we have all email communication between you and everyone in H.B. Gary. So my first question would be, why would you allow Aaron to sell such garbage under your company name? Did you also know that Aaron was peddling fake, wrong, false information, leading to the potential arrest of innocent people?" "We have no idea," responded Penny. "We have not seen the list, and we are kind of pissed at him right now." "If what you are saying is true, then why is Aaron meeting with the FBI tomorrow morning at 11 a.m., retorted Sabu. "Please keep in mind we have all your emails." Sabu demanded that H.B. Gary fire Barr and donated stake in H.B. Gary Federal to the Bradley Manning Defense Fund. In the bizarre scrum that followed, Levy debated the morality of Bradley Manning's actions with dozens of angry hackers. And eventually, Barr and Hoglund jumped into the Anonymous snake pit and tried to defend their company's actions. After 4 hours of arguments, Anonymous decided to publish Greg Hoglund's email, too. AnonLeaks exposed more dirt than the hackers had ever dreamed possible. Barr's plan to unmask Anonymous provided them with humorous reading. Benjamin Spock DeVries, whom Barr had identified as Commander X, turned out to be a permaculture expert whose anarchist activities only extended as far as home gardening. But Barr's emails also revealed H.B. Gary Federal's spec work online, surveilling and tracking enemies of the Chamber of Commerce, the firm's possession of malicious software capable of rooting deep into an unsuspecting user's machine, even Barr's arguments with his wife in which she threatened divorce. And then there was Barr's attack plan against WikiLeaks. The secret spilling group immediately posted the slides to WikiLeaks' homepage as evidence of the corrupt and illegal conspiracies against it. And as the press and blogs began to pick up the story, H.B. Gary Federal's partners increasingly abandoned Barr to the wolves. While Hunton and Williams declined to comment to the media, Berico, Palantir, and the client that had started the entire chain of events, Bank of America, all released statements disclaiming responsibility for the attack plan and severing relations with H.B. Gary Federal. The security firm went into damage control mode. Barr canceled his talk at the B-Sides conference and stopped giving press interviews. Hoglund canceled a talk of his own at the simultaneous RSA conference in San Francisco. As the company went silent, Glenn Greenwald and others wrote excoriating essays on the military-industrial complex's dirty tactics in the digital realm. The Colbert Report aired a segment mocking Barr. A few days later, he resigned from his position at H.B. Gary Federal. A year later, the small company would persist in name alone, without employees or customers. And in February 2012, its parent firm, H.B. Gary, would be swallowed up by the larger defense contractor, Mantech, for an undisclosed price. On the news site Anon News, frequented by members of the movement, Anons reacted to the news of Barr's resignation with little sympathy. "Anonymous should be as cold as ice and get on to the next operation," wrote one. "Poor Aaron Barr," added another. "Wait, no, that guy was a dick. At least we destroyed him in Anonymous style." In the months that followed Barr's takedown, several of the pseudonymous hackers who made references to participating in the hack in chat rooms and media interviews were arrested. An anonymity service called Hide My Ass, which some Anons had used in lieu of Tor, admitted it turned over data to law enforcement in response to a court order. The captured hackers included T-Flow, a 16-year-old boy from South London, Topiary, a.k.a. Jake Davis, a 19-year-old who lived in the UK's isolated Shetland Islands, and Kayla, a hacker who claimed to be a 16-year-old girl but was actually a 24-year-old man in Doncaster. At the time of this writing, their prosecution is ongoing. It would be more than a year before the FBI unsealed its indictment against the hacker Sabu, also known as Hector Xavier Monsegur, a 28-year-old New York man outed by a single occasion when he had entered an anonymous chat room without disguising his IP address. Monsegur had pleaded guilty to computer hacking and other crimes in August of 2011. Faced with 124 years and 6 months in prison, he instead became a government informant, aiding the FBI in its takedown of his friends. In the end, the hacker who humiliated Aaron Barr achieved what Aaron Barr couldn't. He had infiltrated and identified Anonymous's inner circle. In August 2011, Peter Zatko walked onto the main stage of the Black Hat Hacker Conference at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas, wearing a sleek tan sport jacket and jeans, with a room-shaking bass beat announcing his entrance to a crowd of thousands. He began his keynote address with a kind of acknowledgement that he was no longer Mudge the Hacker, who headlined Black Hat in 1999, but now Mudge the high-ranking Department of Defense official. Old Mudge would ask current Mudge, "Did you sell out? Or are you still doing what you believe in and trying to put a dent in the universe?" Mudge asked himself. Leaving the question unanswered, he launched into a talk on his work at DARPA, focusing on his plan to give small grants to loft-style hackerspaces. In his hour-long talk before Black Hat's assembly of hackers and security researchers, he mentioned Cinder only once and described it as having nothing to do with humans. When I followed up by email with Mudge and his public affairs officer to ask what that meant, they would tell me an entirely different story from the one Mudge had described in his public request for proposals and in our meeting the previous year. While the Cinder program did not initially preclude the consideration of human insiders, the primary goal of the program has always been to identify future autonomous software insider activities, read an email from DARPA public affairs officer Eric Mazzacone. The program manager revised and refocused each of the Phase 1 efforts to replace any semblances of human insiders in their missions with software agents while retaining the same mission goals. The program manager revised and refocused each of the Phase I efforts to replace any semblances of human insiders in their missions with software agents while retaining the same mission goals. Never mind that Mudge had specifically spoken about rogue employees who steal data by burning it to a CD, or that DARPA's official description of the project, posted to its website, included an example malicious mission of a human printing files and walking out of a building, a description that was never changed, even many months and several revisions of the document later, or that every contractor who spoke to me about the project, including one who had passed Cinder's first round and remains involved today, described it as including human leakers. Perhaps Mudge had decided that Cinder would be better off focusing on problems with less controversy than rooting out potential whistleblowers. Or perhaps DARPA hoped to make it appear that way. But by the time Mudge's public description of Cinder had changed, the project had entered a phase without public documentation, with participating contractors sworn to secrecy. At the end of his talk at Black Hat, Mudge returned to his original question. I hope that the old Mudge of 1999 is looking at the current Mudge of 2011, he said. And other than saying, why are you wearing a pocket square and don't have any long hair? That, yeah, you're still remaining true to the cause. Then the applause and the bass beat swelled again, and he walked off the stage. 2 hours later, I leave the casino's conference center, descend its three-story escalator, and find my way through the lobby to a Chinese restaurant with massive goldfish tanks at its entrance. Waiting outside is a man with an athletic build, wearing a baseball hat, a Pearl Jam t-shirt, and a wary smile that seems to acknowledge that many of the people in the crowded lobby have read hundreds of his emails. Aaron Barr. It's a bit surreal, he tells me with a self-effacing smile after we sit down. I hope this doesn't sound overly inflated, but I think I have a small window of what celebrities must feel like, to have so much of your life on public display, even while you're still going on in your own little bubble with all your personal relationships. Barr's spat with Anonymous has only strengthened his antipathy toward the group. He wants to emphasize that he's not against civil disobedience. He tells me emphatically about how he led a protest against Walmart in 2004. Fighting the store's opening on behalf of the small businesses in the Colorado town where he lived. What Barr opposes, he says, is the abuse of anonymity. Anonymous believes what they're doing is like holding a virtual sit-in. It sounds good, but it's not equivalent, he says. If you want to protest unfair or broken laws, get a lot of people together, involve the press, and get arrested. Don't throw rocks from the shadows of an alley. That just looks mean. And what about anonymity for whistleblowers? Some amount of anonymity is good, he responds quickly. You look at countries like Iran and Syria. Those folks need to have some ability to have anonymity to get information out. And what about in a functioning democracy, I ask, like the United States? Barr pauses. And then he asks for a moment to think. To all appearances, it's not a question he's considered before. We sit in silence for perhaps a full minute as Barr looks at the menu. When the waitress comes by our table, Barr still seems preoccupied and asks for only the same bowl of noodles and a cup of coffee that I order. In a free and open democracy, it should be attributable, he answers finally. That's one of my problems with anonymity. In most whistleblowing cases, there's a lot of personal risk and sacrifice. Their name's going to be attached to it. There are personal repercussions. There's pressure to get the information right, to get the perspective right. With anonymity, he adds, his uncertainty gone, there's none of that. Barr can philosophize about identity and anonymity with me, but for legal reasons, he warns me that he can't talk about his actual work with HB Gary Federal to unmask and defeat faceless actors online. In fact, he doesn't need to. Deep in the thousands of hacked emails released by Anonymous sits H.B. Gary Federal's very own proposal to Mudge's Cinder program, Barr's unique contribution to the state of the art for tracking down leakers. He called it the paranoia meter. In the document, H.B. Gary Federal offered to build a piece of spyware to be installed on every user's machine in an organization. It would be hidden deep within the operating system to avoid detection, and would communicate with a central server only by weaving its communications into the user's web traffic, impersonating the exchange of data packets to web advertising servers. From its perch inside the potential leaker's machine, it would watch every move he or she made, constantly collecting screenshots of the user's computer, mouse movements, and even using the computer's front-facing camera to watch for suspicious twitches. We believe that during particularly risky activities, we will see more erratic mouse movements and keystrokes, as well as physical observations such as surveying surroundings, shifting more frequently, etc., read the proposal Barr submitted to DARPA. Like a lie detector detects biological and physical changes based on sensitivities to specific questions, we believe there are physical changes in the body that are represented in observable behavioral changes when committing actions someone knows is wrong. Using shoplifting as an example, there are peaks and valleys of adrenaline during the entire theft process. There is the moment the thief puts an item in their pocket, high. Then as they walk around the store, the adrenaline begins to valley a bit. Then they attempt to walk out of the store, very high. It is at these points that we want to be able to take as many behavioral measurements as possible, because it is at these points the insider's activity will be as far from normal behavior. H.B. Gary didn't intend to stop with monitoring only military machines either. It asked to retain the intellectual property of its paranoia meter to transition to commercial products, according to the proposal. Mudge, it seems, was not impressed. Barr's paranoia meter was rejected in Cinder's first round with a form letter from Zatko himself. The note merely thanked the firm for applying and offered no explanation. Perhaps DARPA was disturbed by the company's unapologetic invasion of users' privacy. Or perhaps by the time of Barr's submission, Mudge had already shifted Cinder's focus to automated software instead of humans, as he would later claim. Regardless, since the first round of submissions ended in March 2011, DARPA no longer publicizes any of the contractors that have received funding. If a paranoia meter has found its way into DARPA's budget, reconceived in a form that better suits the agency's standards, Mudge isn't telling. For now, the results of his work, like the information it's meant to protect, have become another sealed file in the Pentagon's Vault of Secrets. The individuals tasked with rooting out leaks, from Adrian Lamo to Aaron Barr, tend to compare their targets to Robert Hansen and Aldrich Ames, spies who sold uncountable secrets to foreign empires for millions of dollars. In fact, the archetypal leaker is often more like one NSA analyst named Thomas Drake, a conscientious whistleblower repaid only with crushing legal retribution. Drake, a thin and severe-looking man with a wisp of brown hair, has the hard stare of someone who has dealt in serious affairs and seen them go very badly. Drake's troubles began on his first full day of work at the National Security Agency, September 11, 2001. To the NSA, the horrors of that day represented its gaping inadequacies in the new millennium. The agency had intercepted but ignored phases in the hijackers' communications, including "Tomorrow is 0 hour" and "The match begins tomorrow." The digital world's vast and messy flood of information had diluted those key warnings into insignificance. The NSA was drowning in data. Drake's first position at the agency, after a career in Air Force Signals Intelligence, was on a project codenamed Jackpot. Jackpot aimed to analyze the agency's software to sniff out bugs and inefficiencies. One piece of code came to Drake's attention: a data sifting algorithm known as ThinThread. The program had been built by the agency's brilliant mathematician, Bill Binney, to address the Internet's deluge of digital information. And Drake assessed it as a highly effective, scalable, and elegant tool, one that might have caught the needles in the digital haystack that represented 9/11 if it had only been implemented in time. Before September 11th, ThinThread had been dismissed as too invasive of Americans' privacy. Binney had responded by altering the program to encrypt all its results so that they would only be made available with a court order. But after 2001, the landscape had changed. In the bureaucratic hand-wringing that followed America's worst-ever terrorist attack, the NSA's leadership was looking for a solution to match the size of its problems, not a single simple program. It launched a new project called Trailblazer, with 9-figure resources aimed at funding private contractors to build new data-combing tools. Drake would come to see the decision to pursue Trailblazer instead of ThinThread as a corrupt, negligent, and wasteful move. Trailblazer became a corporate solution, he said when we met in the Washington, D.C. office of the Government Accountability Project, a whistleblower advocacy group. We disregarded the traditional strength of the NSA, solving problems with the best minds of the private sector and the government, and instead turned the entire project over to industry. You always have to look at alternative options. They chose not to. Over the next years, Trailblazer doled out massive contracts. Hundreds of millions went to the contractor SAIC, which had hired a former NSA director and formerly employed the NSA deputy director at the time. What Drake describes as a revolving door refined to an art form. But even as it overran its budget, Trailblazer ran into endless delays and dead ends. By the time the project was canceled in 2006, it had become a $1.2 billion boondoggle. Drake says he could see the monumental waste in Trailblazer from the start. It didn't matter if ThinThread was better. They just wanted to spend a lot of money over many years. Corruption had become normalized, he says. It still chaps my lips today to think about it. The amount of money wasted that never contributed to national security, and no one has ever been held accountable. In the early days of the program, Drake and three other NSA officials approached one of the agency's budget overseers on the House Intelligence Committee to alert her to the project's overblown costs and ineffectiveness. She passed on the criticisms to others on the committee and even Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist, but no one acted to rein in the program. In 2005, Drake faced the last resort of so many ignored internal whistleblowers: anonymous digital communications with the press. He signed up for an account with Hushmail, an encrypted email service, and, using a proxy to disguise his IP address, began sending messages about Trailblazer's alleged corruption to Siobhan Gorman, a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. His pseudonym? The Shadow Knows. With the paranoia of an NSA analyst, Drake took a certain amount of caution in those missives. He installed 4 layers of firewalls on his home network and used a 256-character password on his encrypted email account, the longest the service would accept. Even then, Drake eventually decided physical meetings would be more difficult to eavesdrop, and trusted Gorman enough that he believed meeting her in person would be safer. There is no absolute anonymity electronically, says Drake. There are means that make it more difficult to identify you, but there's always a digital trail. Drake says he made certain to never share classified documents in his dealings with Gorman, only testifying to Trailblazer's fiscal waste. In early 2006, as Trailblazer was collapsing, The Sun published an award-winning series of articles about the NSA's problems, including one that focused on Trailblazer. But by then, the agency was concerned about a leak of far larger proportions. A few months before, The New York Times had published its story detailing how the NSA had engaged in widespread illegal spying on Americans. In the post-9/11 era, The privacy concerns that had shelved ThinThread were now an anachronism. According to the Times story, a new project was now hoovering up phone conversations and internet traffic without the encryption and court order protections that ThinThread had implemented. Warrantless wiretapping. Every line was crossed, says Drake. They had turned the U.S. into a foreign nation electronically. The Bush administration, which had pleaded with the Times not to publish the story, was humiliated and furious. A Department of Justice witch hunt set out to find the newspaper's sources. Drake had participated in official protests against Trailblazer and also provided classified information to Congress during its investigation of intelligence failures before September 11th. Those two actions were easily enough to pull him into the Justice Department's dragnet. In November 2007, a team of armed FBI agents arrived at his home. Drake sensed that the agents had no interest in Trailblazer, and he believed that his communications with Gorman were both legal and insignificant compared to the leak that had exposed the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. So he decided on the spot to come clean and spent the day sitting with the agents at his kitchen table, debriefing them on his whistleblowing activities to avoid any confusion with their investigation. He gave the investigators full access to his computers, and they carted away boxes full of his papers. Eventually, the FBI would identify Department of Justice lawyer Thomas Tam as at least one source for the New York Times expose. But Tam was never prosecuted, likely for fear that his trial would expose too many details of the secret surveillance program that have yet to come to light. Instead, they indicted Drake. Drake was accused of illegally taking classified papers from his office to his home under a section of the Espionage Act, the same spy hunting law used to indict Daniel Ellsberg and Bradley Manning. He faced 10 felony charges and 35 years in prison, and his case was pursued for more than 2.5 years without a trial. The prosecutor in the case argued that Drake should be used to send a message to the silent majority of people who live by secrecy agreements. Finally, just days before his court date in 2011, the prosecution admitted that it had vastly exaggerated the classification of the documents Drake had been holding. Drake pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge that carried a year of probation and community service. In the sentencing hearing, the judge in the case called the prosecution's behavior in exaggerating the charges against Drake inappropriate and unconscionable. By that point, Drake had spent $82,000 in legal fees, taken a second mortgage on his house, and been dismissed from his job both at the NSA and as an instructor at the National Defense University. Factoring in his lost pension after decades of military service, he estimates his financial damages in the millions. His Pentagon colleagues cut ties with him. He was separated from his wife for a year. Even his father, a World War II veteran, struggled to understand his actions. Today, he works at a Washington, D.C. Apple store for an hourly wage. "I worked with the system, and I got fried," he says. Thomas Drake's story is hardly unique. The Obama administration has pursued more leakers under espionage charges than all other presidential administrations combined. They include Jeffrey Sterling, an ex-CIA analyst who gave information to author James Risen about how the agency had botched an attempt to sabotage Iran's nuclear development plans. Lawyer and FBI translator Shammai Leibowitz pleaded guilty to leaking classified transcripts of bugged conversations in the Israeli embassy to the blog Tikkun Olam in the hopes of stemming Israeli aggression toward Iran. Stephen Kim, an arms expert for the State Department, the military, and Lawrence Livermore National Lab, was prosecuted for leaking a report to Fox News on North Korea's plans to develop a nuclear weapon. Ex-CIA officer John Kiriakou, who at times defended and criticized the Bush administration's use of waterboarding, was indicted for revealing the name of two of the agency's interrogators to media, including the New York Times. As of this writing, prosecutions of Kiriakou, Kim, and Sterling continue, as does that of Bradley Manning. All totaled, that makes 6 leakers prosecuted under the Espionage Act, compared with 3 such cases in all previous history. The Obama administration may yet pursue a 7th case with the prosecution of Julian Assange. All of which adds up to an unlikely track record for a president who came to office spouting promises of unprecedented government transparency and proclaiming on his official website in 2009 that whistleblowing is an act of courage and patriotism which can sometimes save lives and often save taxpayer dollars and should be encouraged rather than stifled. Where did that evident hypocrisy come from? Obama has been co-opted by Washington's culture of secrecy, argues Jesselyn Raddick, a lawyer at the Government Accountability Project who has advised Drake, and who once served as a whistleblower herself, leaking evidence of Justice Department ethics violations to Newsweek in 2002. He wants to curry favor with the national intelligence community, where he's perceived as weak, she says. But Drake, who has tasted secret information many times over in his career, offers an explanation of Obama's behavior that comes closer to the speech about Circe's potion that Daniel Ellsberg once gave to Henry Kissinger. He had never had that kind of access to secrets before, says Drake. It was a lot of power. He was enamored with it, and it changed him.